Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Today I'll be talking with Bay Area actress, musical theater artist, and comedian Maureen McVerry to discuss her new solo cabaret show, hashtag VeryMcVerry 2019, for one night only, this Saturday at the Oasis here in San Francisco. I'll talk with actor-playwright Wayne Harris about his award-winning, music-infused, spiritual, and uplifting show, Mother's Milk, which returns to the Marsh, Berkeley, musing on life, death, and the Baptist Church. Across the bridge, in the other Marsh here in San Francisco, we'll welcome back Bay Area playwright Lynn Kaufman to discuss the world premiere of her new play, Who Killed Sylvia Plath, at the Marsh, San Francisco. Celebrated actress Laurie Holt, who plays the title role, will join the conversation by phone. We'll also talk about the United States of Asian America Festival, USAAF, at the Asian Pacific Islander Cultural Center, with the center's artistic director, Melanie Elvena. She'll be joined by Irene Tu, named one of the Bay Area's best stand-up comedians, whose show happens as part of the events. Also, we'll learn more about the full festival, which is a 2-month-long festival. Stay with us here on Open Air.
I knew this woman named Ruth. Her face was round like the moon, and when she smiled, her cheeks puffed up like biscuits rising. She loved raising babies, cooking, and singing in the church choir, and she made the best banana pudding I have ever had. Yes, Lord, the best banana pudding I have ever had. Now, she was born a light-skinned colored girl to a mama who liked to frequent them juke joints outside of Little Rock, Arkansas. Hey, baby, why don't you buy a gal a drink? Now, mama didn't bear much mind, but that little girl with a round face and chubby cheeks, she could bring a warmth into any room she was in. A gentle feel, you might say, like a warm evening. Sitting on the porch. When them lightning bugs is flying and the sun be getting low on a Mississippi city as the street lights start to glow, when them lightning bugs is flying and the sun be getting low on a Mississippi city, as the street lights start to glow, hold it on to a love, a never-ending torch, like a warm St. Louis evening.
That's just a taste of what you're in for Wayne Harris's award-winning, music-infused, spiritual, and uplifting Mother's Milk. It's back at the Marsh, Berkeley. Original songs, traditional blues, gospel classics come together to underscore an intricate and uplifting narrative on life, death, and the Baptist Church. And what I'm told is the best recipe for banana pudding ever.
Absolutely.
It's set against the background of the Civil Rights Movement, a losing battle with breast cancer, and a slightly inebriated preacher. Here to tell us more about the show, which is at the Marsh through the end of this month, is actor-playwright Wayne Harris, whose other creative hats worn include being a writer, educator, curriculum innovator, and musician. He's written and starred in 5 full-length solo plays, including Tyrone Shortleg Johnson and Some White Boys, for which he received the 2012 Best of Fringe Award at the San Francisco Fringe Festival. Wayne is the head of the Marsh Youth Theater Program and has worked with the Marsh since 1996, where he was first exposed to storytelling through theater. He's also committed to music education, directing and designing performances for schools and pageantry groups. Wayne, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon, David. Thanks for having me.
And you get to do it all in this show, don't you?
Yeah, I kind of got lost in the introduction. That guy's pretty impressive.
Well, let's talk about the show, which is very autobiographical, musing on your childhood in St. Louis, was it?
Yes, yes.
Not such a happy home environment, I understand.
Well, you know, like most families, it had two sides of the coin. It was a kind of a strict environment, to say the least, but it was very loving. Like I said, two sides of the coin, that both musically and in terms of the care and feeding.
An abusive father, a not so supportive uncle.
Actually, not an uncle. We called him,
Uncle Bill.
Uncle Bill.
Uh-huh.
But he really wasn't our uncle. Everybody called Uncle Bill, Uncle Bill. All uh-huh. the kids in the neighborhood, all the folks at church. But actually, he became our stepfather.
Uh-huh. But kind of a curmudgeon.
Somewhat.
So I understand he, you know, he kept the lights off in the house to save money, wouldn't let you sing or make music, and you found as an outlet music to really save yourself.
Oh, absolutely, you know, Uncle Bill, unless you paying the electric bill, turn off the damn light.
My father was similar with the thermostat.
I gotcha.
Cold Connecticut evenings, that's for sure.
But I have to give him credit for marrying my mother with five kids. And, you know, he kept a roof over our head and partnered with my mother. And like I said, he had the other side, and that kind of pushed me out of the house in order to kind of seek my own way in the world.
Mm-hmm. I'm the youngest of seven, so I know what a large family is like to share the roof with.
Absolutely.
And I also know the key role that the mother figure plays in the family, especially so in black families, do you think?
Well, you know, this story is a very simple story. It like a good haiku, though, in its simplicity, hopefully it sheds light on a much larger story. My family, like many black families, after the Second World War, there was a migration from the South. My mother was originally from Little Rock, Arkansas, so was my father. And when my father got back from the war, like many black men, he had seen the world. And was not ready to make do with the old South, and so they went north to St. Louis. He started working for the railroad, and she started having us, and she became such a large part of the shaping of all five of us kids through her modeling of just this unconditional love, mm-hmm. which hopefully permeates the play throughout.
And this is all happening at the height of the civil rights movement. What sort of environment was that like for you growing up?
Well, David, being of a certain age, when I was growing up, most of the black churches in St. Louis followed and supported Martin Luther King and, you know, his people's focus on gaining civil rights. However, on the streets of St. Louis, there was an obvious lean toward Bobby Seale and mm-hmm. those people's
Malcolm
approach.
X and that approach. Uh-huh.
And as a young child, you know, we respected Martin Luther King, but the Black Panthers had such cool black jackets, you know, so that kind of directed our focus.
Right, right. It's a question of having that patience where Mr. King, Dr. King, was looking for the bigger picture or wanting something done that's overdone and needs to get done right now.
Absolutely. And the idea of black pride, the idea of self-determination, those were much stronger concepts. And for a young black young man growing up in St. Louis, the tendency was to move that way and try to find myself there.
Mm-hmm. And so growing up in a household that didn't want to have, your uncle Bill did not want to have music in your house, I imagine hearing the gospel music in the church was a great outlet for you then.
Well, actually, Uncle Bill did not say no to music in the house. In fact, my mother was constantly singing
okay.
in the house. She was part of a gospel singing group that used to travel the circuit from Little Rock up through St. Louis into Chicago, and they would go to various churches to sing, and so I grew up with not only singing in the church, but believe me, singing in my mother's kitchen.
And this show is especially music heavy, not only with your own performing, but you're backed by a great bunch of musicians, bass player John McArdle and pianist Randy Craig.
I am blessed to have those two guys sharing this this story with me. Randy, he's old school. He goes back to the Pickle Family Circus days.
Sure.
And John has played with Al Jarreau and greats up and down the line in terms of jazz and blues. One of the things that we wanted to do with Mother's Milk was to tap into the two avenues of music and culture that I grew up with. Like I said, my mother was a gospel singer. My father, however, loved the blues. And on the street I grew up on St. Louis Avenue, right on the corner there, was an old blues bar. And typically, summer evenings in St. Louis, you would just, hear Willie Dixon coming down the street. And so as we started to look at some of the stories I had written before, many of these stories were written 10, 12 years ago. We talked about the stories and about the environment and how they could fit the narrative. And so we chose from both gospel and blues songs. We're doing iconic tunes from the Reverend Cleveland, James Cleveland, and doing iconic tunes from Blind Willie Johnson and Billie Holiday. And so you get this combination that what I think was part and parcel of me being the person I am today and able to appreciate and share.
Mm-hmm. So part of the poignancy of the title Mother's Milk comes from, okay, you're in this home environment, you leave home with music as part of your escape to California, of all places, and then returning home to deal with your mother's breast cancer. So that was a interesting and probably a very sad way to return to a home environment.
You know, David, early on, I joined the local Baptist church drum and bugle corps. I played bugle when I was 9 years old. And we used to march in parades and field competitions, and we would travel. And I loved marching in the parades and marching in the field competitions, but I loved marching away from St. Louis. And so I kept getting with better groups that took me even further and further away, absolutely to California, but eventually actually to Canada. And I lived there for 10 years and got married and kind of started my life and was rarely in touch with St. Louis, you know, by phone. You know, you call mom on holidays and natural disasters, right? And, one day I got a phone call from my older sister saying that my mother had breast cancer and that they were going to perform a mastectomy. David, I didn't even know she was sick.
Mm-hmm.
So that started the process of me going back home. And much of what Mother's Milk is about those 2.5-3 years of me kind of taking the journey back home and kind of reconnecting.
Did that reconnect you with your siblings as well in a more profound level?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So this is a return of the show. What sort of changes have happened since its original incarnation? And was David Ford the incredible incubator of all things theatrical
yes.
at the Marsh involved in the first incarnation as well?
David Ford has been my director since late 90s and been a part of the development of most of the work I've done, and I'm blessed to have had him in my corner all of this time. Like I said, some of these stories started as a little Monday night at the Marsh. You get 15 minutes and, you know, I was trying out stories. And over the years, we kind of built them up in various ways. What makes this version of these stories different in a large way is that we've introduced music, but we are at the large theater in the Berkeley Marsh. And most of the times, most of our solo performers are using the front part of the stage. Well, there is a huge amount of stage there that no one ever uses. And one day I was kind of drawing the curtains, and I looked back there, and I said, you know, it would be nice to play vertically as well, because we play so much in a linear sense, mm-hmm. and trying to really get an opportunity to create location and to actually move with purpose. Not only do we have depth to the stage, but we've got risers. So delineating location and like I said, moving with purpose to a place in order for a scene to happen is much stronger in this environment, and it's actually informed the storytelling.
Did contemporary events at all influence the evolvement of the story from the triumph and the heights of electing someone like Obama to the, let's face it, the polar opposite right now of what we're facing in the White House?
You know, as I go through the stories and pick and choose which ones we wanted to use, it was more about continuity and having a moving and kind of forward motion to the storytelling. What's been interesting is how words that were written 12 years ago are speaking to me in different ways. How when we speak to a police brutality in the play, it certainly is an experience we are still dealing with today. The idea of trying to find your spirituality, the idea of trying to look past the dogmas and the rituals to try to find a real connection with a higher power is timeless. Mm-hmm. So all of those things are still informing.
And you had a special Mother's Day performance. That must have been especially poignant for you.
It was beautiful. We first of all, it was sold out, which is always great. But we reached out to folks to bring their mothers or mothers to come, and we gave out roses, and there was lemonade and banana. Bananas and vanilla wafers.
Okay, you didn't give out the recipe for the banana pudding?
No,
we haven't even talked about that yet.
If you listen to the play closely, you would, in fact, get the recipe for banana pudding.
All right. The show runs through May 31st. Mother's Milk, a blues and gospel play in three acts, written and performed by Wayne Harris, with original music and arrangements by Randy Craig and John McArdle, directed by David Ford. At the Marsh in Berkeley, themarsh.org, for more information. France, San Francisco Examiner says whether he's channeling various characters or just singing as himself, he mesmerizes. Wayne Harris, thanks so much for coming in today.
David, thank you so much for having me.
Of course. Go out with a little Billie Holiday here. God bless the child. And more from the Marsh on this side of the bridge a little later in the show. And more to come here on Open Air. I do need to remind you that we are in our spring membership campaign, and we've had a generous pair of tickets donated by the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus. You'll get a pair of tickets to the concert coming up on June 22nd at 2:30 p.m. and their new CD for a $240 pledge. That's just $20 a month. That's easy to do. Make it a sustaining pledge at 800-525-9917. Ask for the tickets for the Gay Men's Chorus coming up. Always an amazing performance and show. And you get the bonus CD on that $240 pledge. Also, we still have tickets, one pair left, for Beautiful, the Carole King musical. Here for 2 weeks only, you'll have opening night tickets to Carole King. Not Carole King, of course, but Beautiful, the musical about Carole King. That's on Wednesday, May 28th at the Golden Gate Theater. That's for $1 a day pledge, a $365 pledge, when you call 800-525-9917. And our good friends at the San Francisco Playhouse, a very theater-rich program today. Well, you can get three pairs of tickets to any show in the season that coming up, or even use them this season, and it'll include a drink voucher for two, that also for $1 a day pledge, $365, when you call 800-525-9917 on this, our penultimate day of our spring membership campaign. Let's go out on a strong note and support Open Air and everything we do here at KLW.
But God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own. got lots of friends. They're crowded round your door. But when you're gone and spending ends, they don't come.
Good afternoon once again. I'm David LaTulipe, and you're listening to Open Air on local public radio, KALW. The Asian Pacific Islander Cultural Center presents its 22nd annual United States of Asian America Festival, a two-month showcase highlighting the experiences of local Asian Pacific Islander artists and communities. It began on May 2nd and coincides with Asian Pacific American Heritage Month. The festival bridges together over 25 producing artists to celebrate the breadth and cultural impact of API art making. This year's festival features artist comedian Irene Tu, who will perform in Rest in Peace, Irene, a hybrid storytelling and stand-up show, and she's my guest in studio today. Irene is a stand-up comedian, actor, and writer, named one of the Bay Area's best stand-up comedians and an artist on the brink of fame. Irene has performed at numerous festivals and opened for Patton Oswalt as well as W. Kamau Bell. Welcome to you, Irene.
Thanks for having me, David.
Of course. And she's joined by Melanie Elvena, the Artistic Director of the Asian Pacific Islander Cultural Center. Welcome to you, Melanie.
Thank you for having me on the air today, David.
Of course. 22 years.
Yes.
Goodness gracious. And so each year has a different theme. Tell us what this theme is for this year and how it came about.
So our theme this year is collective memories. I meet together with my staff every year to sort of come up with what are some issues, themes, things that are affecting our communities today. And unfortunately, in the last couple of years, the Asian and Pacific Islander community has had a lot of loss, actually. We were thinking about folks like Dr. Don Mabalan, who's was a Filipino-American educator and activist, as well as Pete Yamamoto, who was a Japanese-American poet that came out of the International Hotel, as well as recently Jeff Adachi, who not only was our SF public defender, but was also a well-known filmmaker within our community as well.
I didn't know that, huh?
Yes, he was. He featured a lot of his films in CamFest, which is actually right now.
Right.
And yeah, so we were thinking about this and we were feeling a little like down, a little like at a loss. So we wanted to create a theme that people could respond to, where we could reflect upon some of the people who have contributed to our arts community, some of our leaders, such as the folks that I've just mentioned, as well as how to honor them and how to come together to reflect on their legacy and what our artists are doing now to continue that legacy.
Fantastic. And how did you come up across the great Irene Tu to get become involved this year?
So Irene Tu, I've been working with her for the last few years. She's been in our festival, and most recently we decided to have a featured artist for our festival. This is our second year, and so I immediately was like, Irene Tu, she's been in our festival. She always brings something really interesting. I think she kind of encapsulates what our artists do. She brings an interesting perspective to our festival, and you know, everyone loves seeing her shows every year, so why not, you know, bring her on and have her
bigger
do
showcase,
her
sure.
solo show.
So, Irene, tell us a little bit about your style of comedy.
Well, I kind of really like dark comedy, which I think is funny coming from me, because if you look at me, I feel like I seem fun, but I have like a very dark side. So when Melanie was like, hey, do you want to do the festival this year? And she mentioned the theme, I really kind of gravitated toward it because I wanted to do like a darker show. And I normally just do stand-up. I just tell jokes. But I wanted to do a show that had a little bit less funny in it, but I did want to find the funny in death.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can we get remember we're on public radio?
Yes.
Can we get a bit of a sample of something that you'd be doing in the show?
Tell us a story. I talk about I decided to do the show because I've actually never really experienced death in my life to somebody really close to me. Like, my grandparents are still alive, my parents are around, so I tell a lot of stories about my family and just like being concerned that they'll die one day and I don't know what to do with my life. So it's kind of based on that.
Okay.
And one thing Irene just didn't mention, she's actually hosting her own funeral.
Right. So to confront my fear of death, I decided it would be funny to host my own funeral.
What sort of eulogizing do you do for yourself?
I do eulogies that I imagine other people would do for me.
Okay. All
yeah.
Right. Let's hear a little bit.
Well, I don't want to spoil the show because that's the funny part of it. Right. But I do like at one point do a eulogy from the perspective of my mom.
Okay. How do you self-identify in terms of the queer culture?
I guess I identify as a lesbian, though I hate that word because I feel like it sounds gross.
Lesbian. Yeah.
It sounds like a disease in a way. So I usually say gay, but I guess it would be lesbian.
Okay.
Yeah.
And where else have you performed then in terms of your stand-up stuff?
All the clubs in the Bay, and I've done the festival before, so I love Bindlestiff Studio. It's a little black box theater, which I love doing stand-up in. And then I used to run a bunch of shows at, like, different bars. And right now, the only show I still have is I do a show every Monday at the Starline Social Club in Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, like, where I try out new material, basically.
Well, okay. Well, let's try out some new material here. You don't have to give anything away about yeah. Rest in Peace, but here's your 5 minutes of stand-up time and our open mic.
Oh, man. it's not going to work because I won't know if anyone's laughing on air because they're far away from me.
Well, we've got a studio audience yeah. that can laugh.
I don't have anything that I feel like would be appropriate for radio.
Okay, well, fair enough.
Yeah, because I am working on a new bit, but I definitely cannot do it on air.
I'll tell you about a character that was in the Book of Mormon that told me his character's title that wasn't ready for radio either.
Oh, no. Did he do it on air?
And he did it on air, yeah.
Did you bleep it?
No, there's no filter here.
There's no bleep.
Melanie, tell us a little bit more about what else is happening as part of the festival.
So we have this weekend.
Again, it's 2 months long.
Yes,
goodness.
2 months. It's a beast of festival, but, you know, we have fun every year. And this weekend we have an exhibition, a visual arts exhibition and performances that's having a joint reception, Jaga Jadu, at Mission Cultural Center on May 17. It's actually a collaboration between two different groups, SNM, which is a South Asian transgender arts collective, and then Jaga Collective, which is a female South Asian visual arts collective. So they actually met through our festival process and decided to do two exhibitions in the space, but they're doing a joint opening reception. So that's this weekend as well. And so we're excited for that.
Someone from the Hummingbird Farm is coming on June 9th, I understand?
Yes, yes. On June 9th, the Rooted Recipes project. They're doing an event at the Hummingbird Farm on June 9th, and it's going to have like workshops. There's going to be a huge community meal that culminates the event. But attendees will actually come and take part in creating different parts of the meal. So they'll help with the prep, and they'll get to talk to the artists. And it's we've had them in the festival last year. They did a big community dinner over at SoMart's Cultural Center, and it was great. We had over 100 people come for this collective dinner. The artists that are involved with it, they talk about their perspectives from Laos. One of the artists is Laos, one's Filipino, one's Vietnamese. So sort of this coming together of our different communities to talk about different things, and nice. Also over food, which
yeah.
is great.
that's going to be on June 9th.
Yes.
And then the Ulumau Collective, which is going to be presenting Hawaiian cultural arts, history, and traditions. Tell us a little bit about what they'll be doing.
So, yes, Ulumau, we're really excited for them. I actually invited them to come to the festival. They're going to be exploring things about Hawaiian culture through heritage. So they'll have different presentations like traditional tattooing, hula, different things about their food culture over at African American Art and Culture Complex. It's really exciting just because we've never really had anything this extensive that just talks about Hawaiian culture in our festival, but as well they are going to bring a genealogist from Hawaii who's flying in, and they're going to talk about like the perspective of Hawaiian genealogy and how that relates to our modern day and how we can explore our own identities through that sort of genealogy. So very excited for that.
Exploring loss, lineage, and living on. The 22nd Annual Asian American Arts Festival cultivates space for community healing and celebration. The festival runs all through the end of next month and with featured comedian artist Irene Tu. Irene, anything else you want to tell us about the show to entice people to come by?
Just come ready to laugh, and also it is a funeral, so please wear black and bring flowers.
Irene Tu's show, Rest in Peace, Irene, a humorous look at one of life's most serious topics, death, in this solo show. She explores her own funeral and offers some eulogies from others that might hopefully look at her in a good light, shall we say. All of this information is at the festival's website, apiculturalcenter.org. Thank you both for coming in today, and great success with the festival.
Thank you so much, David.
Still to come on Open Air, you'll be hearing from Maureen McVeary about her show at the Oasis and another show at the Marsh. Still to discuss lots more here on Open Air, as we do every week. And as this is our membership campaign for the spring, we encourage you to show your support for Open Air and everything we do here on KLW. A reminder that a pair of tickets to the upcoming concert of the Gay Men's Chorus is yours for a $240 pledge. That concert, always a pleasure to watch the incredible men of the chorus perform and whatever staging they will do. You'll also get a CD that celebrates 50 years of Pride. That's going to be June 22nd at 2:30, $240 pledge when you call 800-525-9917. Also, you know, we still have one pair of tickets available to opening night of Beautiful, the Carole King musical, making its national tour right now. That's going to be opening night Wednesday, May 28th at the Golden Gate Theater. That's yours for a pledge of $365, a dollar a day. You can do that. Put it on a credit card that perhaps gives you some frequent flyer miles or some extra bonuses. That way you're supporting great radio and giving a little perk to yourself at $365. Also for $365, the San Francisco Playhouse, a beautiful venue, and these are incredible people that put these shows on. Three pairs of tickets to any show in any combination for this season. They're doing Cabaret in June. They're ending with Follies next year, and in between a whole bunch of really incredibly creative Playhouse Productions. It'll include a drink voucher for two, a $365 pledge when you call 800-525-9917. 800-525-9917. Well, here's an intriguing setup for a play. Poet Sylvia Plath returns to her burial place in West Yorkshire, England, to view the fourth replacement of her tombstone. The previous ones have been defaced by feminists who chiseled off her married name, claiming it was Ted Hughes who caused Sylvia's death. Did he? Was her suicide at 30 a good career move? Would she do it again? And what does it say to us today? These questions and perhaps some answers are explored in Lynn Kaufman's one-person show, the title of which is Who Killed Sylvia Plath, at the Marsh through the 16th of June. Lynn Kaufman joins me in studio. She's the author of some 20 full-length plays, one of which, Fakes, was optioned for film and TV, three novels and dozens of short stories. In 2018 alone, she had four world premieres done. Welcome, Lynn.
Thank you very much, David.
I should say welcome back, that is. We're also joined by phone by the woman portraying the title character. Lori Holt has been a leading actress in the San Francisco Bay Area for over three decades. And her extensive resume also includes stints in La Jolla, Philadelphia, and internationally. She originated the role of Harper Pitt in Tony Kushner's Angels in America from its very inception and workshop at the Eureka Theater, where she was a company member for some 10 years. More recently, Lori co-wrote with Zach Rogo and starred in her first solo show, Colette Uncensored, which premiered at the Marsh here, jumped the bridge to the Marsh Berkeley, and was subsequently performed to rave reviews in London. Welcome to you, Lori.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for letting me be on.
Get her. Nice. I'm glad you could join us by phone. So busy.
Can you hear?
Yeah, we got you there. You can hear us. Yes.
Yes.
Oh, good. And say hello to Lynn while you're on mic. Lynn's in studio.
Hi,
now.
Lori.
Hi, Lynn.
Well, Lynn, what a fantastic opportunity to get such an acting veteran like Lori Holt. How long have you guys known each other?
Well, I've known about Lori and seen her and fabulous roles for a long time, but the real connection came. I teach a class at the Fromm Institute at USF, and it's called The Art of Storytelling. And I asked Lori to present her wonderful show on Colette, and she did, and it was dynamite. And just toward the end, I said, you know, I'm writing a play about Sylvia Plath. would you ever consider playing Sylvia Plath? And her answer was, but she died when she was 30. You know? And aren't I too old? And no.
Makeup.
No, of course not. Because the conceit is she comes back from the grave. At this time, much wiser and more mature. And you are perfect. And when Laurie said yes, I went and opened a bottle of champagne.
Right.
Well, you did? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well, let's get the undereducated people that may be listening to KLW that need a touch of enlightenment. Let's talk about Sylvia Plath, who she was, why she's such an important figure.
Well, Sylvia Plath is sort of an iconic figure for women. And particularly women writers. I mean, there are a few of them that we think about. We think about Virginia Woolf. We think about Sylvia Plath. And part of it was, you know, with the women's movement, that these women were sort of oppressed. And they had a hard time, you know. And I, of course, relate to Sylvia because that's my era. And this is before the women's movement, before women had a chance to be their full selves. And here is this Sylvia Plath, a brilliant poet. And she won the Pulitzer Prize for Ariel after she died.
Mm-hmm.
So all that fame, this could have been a running joke or irony in our play. It's not dire, mm-hmm. even though it's dealing with a life that is cut off. It is dealing with suicide and is dealing with depression.
Right.
But Sylvia and Laurie playing it, who's wonderful wit and timing, Sylvia comes back and can look somewhat objectively at her younger self and what life was like then, what life is like now. And she talks about it, you know, I died long before Betty Friedan's, you know, the feminine mystique, before bra burning, before Time's Up, before Me Too. And so she's looking at, would my life have been really different if I knew then what I know now, which is the reason we think it's relevant to today's audience. And, you know, it's also dealing with legacy. How do you want to be remembered in your life? And that key question, knowing what I know now, you know, from a fairly mature point of view, mm-hmm. looking back at yourself and seeing that young life,
right,
and
right.
who you were then and who you are now. And I'm giving the gift to Sylvia and bringing her back.
Oh, lovely, yeah. Laurie, how about you? What was your first association with Sylvia Plath?
I read The Bell Jar when I was 14 years old. It affected me deeply. So, I was young. It had just come out, I think, in paperback and started to sell really well about that time. So I was I belonged to a book club in my junior high school. I ordered it and read it, couldn't stop reading it.
And so in addition to this play, did you look at some original source material to get you a little bit more familiar with Sylvia's life and the controversy?
Oh yes, started reading her poetry.
Lynn has a nodding.
Oh,
you can't see Lynn nodding.
She's read everything.
Yeah.
Pardon?
Yeah, I said, you've read everything.
An actor prepares.
Oh, no, I have not read everything. There's tons more to read. There's so much material, it's incredible. But read her letters, some of her letters, her correspondence, her journals. There's going to be more coming out, too, in 2023.
Oh, yeah, true enough. So did you work together with Lynn on the text? Or tell us how this took shape, including the work of your director.
Well, we have collaborated quite a bit in the last year. Lynn would write, do a draft, and then we'd read it in one place or another. Or we did a couple of readings for other playwright friends of Lynn's, and we started working with Jane Wenger, who was helping also to sort of as kind of a dramaturg as we went along and director. But she had some family emergencies that happened, and so she couldn't continue with us. But it's been a wonderful process because Lynn would go away, and I would give whatever feedback I had or suggestions, and she would incorporate them, and if they worked, and then she would come up with the new stuff, and as we developed it, it just became deeper and deeper.
So, and then how did this lead to your character development? Did you play her as vulnerable, a victim, a strong personality, or all of the above?
She has some of everything in there. I think probably when we started doing readings, let me know if you think this is true, Lynn, but it seemed like we started out with her being more, in control and coming back from the grave with a sense of distance, a really big sense of distance. But as we worked on it and the play has gone where it goes, it's a distance it doesn't last that long before she starts reliving part of it, or parts of it as she goes, and kind of as she tells the story, she's back in that time again. And then she pulls herself out of it at times and then goes back in. How do you see that, Lynn?
I think you said it well. She has a line in the play. You said that Ted Hughes said, "I never showed him my true self." Mm. And what Sylvia says is, "But I did. I showed him all myself."
Mm.
And yes. I have been blessed to have this wonderful actress. It's a love fest, and it is, and a wonderful director, David Keith, who played Ramdas for me in the show we did at the Marsh, Acid Test. And so, you know, there's a lot of love in that room. And the brilliant thing is David will say to Lori, "Okay, let's do this as if you're falling apart." Okay. She does it. She says, "No, well, let's do it as if it's kind of funny." Okay. And she does it.
Well, there are so many different ways you can interpret lines in a play, as we all know.
Yeah.
And it was wonderful to have the freedom, because David actually freed me to try a whole lot of things that I might not have tried had he not been there.
Being pliable actor putty is the whole idea if you're going to be in this biz, I should say.
Well, you always have to find a way to make that work and to find the way into it. You can't do things that are not motivated, but when you're freed up to try a lot of things, it's a wonderful feeling of liberation.
So what is probably explored in the play, and maybe a spoiler alert here, do you think it was Ted Hughes that drove Sylvia to suicide, or does that even really matter?
He didn't help.
He didn't help. What exactly was that abusive relationship with?
Oh, there's so, you know, it becomes apocryphal after a while. There are so many different points of view, and people have agendas. Basically, the one fact that we do know is that he left her for another woman, and impregnated, you know, the other woman, left her and their two small children.
Mm-hmm.
Again, if she could have, maybe, if Sylvia would have said, "Fine, you know, I will accept your other women, your muses," as he called them, the marriage might have lasted.
Mm.
When he married again, his wife, Carol, accepted that. So it was a deal breaker for Sylvia. And yeah, did that? Yes. And there was the worst snowstorm in London's history. And she had a history of depression, mm-hmm. and they changed the meds.
Mm.
So
lots of factors.
Lots of factors.
And
Yeah,
please go ahead, Lori.
The perfect storm.
Yeah, perfect storm, sure.
And too many things happening at once. And
mm-hmm. And I mentioned in the introduction that the whole, I guess, does it start with her visiting the grave, her tombstone? That
yes.
Feminists mm-hmm. have chipped off the name
and
Hughes.
And that's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
Mm.
And when he gave poetry readings, he became Poet Laureate of England, thank you very much.
Mm.
And when he gave poetry readings, the feminists would yell at him, "You killed Sylvia Plath." Mm. So this, the play, in a sense, is a response to that.
Interesting. Well, the very prolific Lynn Kaufman, what else are you working on, or what's next on in your black book?
A little plug. This is great. We just set up this event at Marin Theater Company on June 24th. And it's going to be a stage reading of a new play of mine called You Will Not Replace Us. And we have Warren Farrell and John Gray talking about boys in crisis.
Oh, fantastic.
And it's free.
Oh, nice. Where can we learn more about that as it's being developed?
As soon as I put it on.
Well, in the meantime.
In the meantime.
Enjoy Who Killed Sylvia Plath, written by Lynn Kaufman, starring Lori Holt. It's at the Marsh through the 16th, and that's at the Marsh San Francisco, and through June 16th, themarsh.org for more information. Lynn, thanks so much for taking a little bit of time today to talk about that.
Oh, it was a lot of fun. Thank you, David.
And Lori, before you go, let me just ask you about a memory of yours. As my next guest might just have something to share with you. You remember a dressing room back in ACT? When was this?
The House of Mirth.
The House of Mirth. It's Mo.
Maureen McVeary.
Mo?
Yes.
Maureen McVeary is my next guest.
I've been lurking, listening to your interview. God, it's just so great to hear your voice. You never see friends in theater. It just drives you nuts. It's the weirdest thing.
I know. Gosh, I would love to give you a big hug right now.
Oh,
we had a lot
of
fun in that dressing
room. We had so much fun.
Tell us about that shared dressing room, ladies.
Ooh, I don't know if we could do it on the air, actually.
No, I don't think we could.
No.
What was the show?
It was called The House of Mirth, and it was...
Wharton. Adaptation of Edith Wharton's novel.
And I was Carrie and a maid, and you were somebody. She was the straight girl.
I was the friend of the lead. I was her... Oh, gosh.
Oh, yeah, we had a fun cast, though. Oh, we had a fun cast.
I had a great wig. It was really fun. I'm at ACT right now doing the Strand Festival today. We're performing a new play at the Strand, so... It's fun to be back at ACT doing something.
Yeah, baby, I'm excited about that new regime there. I just absolutely loved Vanity Fair. I will give that a plug. Mm-hmm. I just loved it.
Yeah.
So much joy coming off the stage, I thought.
Good energy around you, lots of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, great.
Well, Lori, here's a radio hug from us all. Mwah! How's that?
Thank you so much.
All right, you take care, and we'll have you back on in studio when you're back on this part of the
year. Bye, Lori.
See you soon.
Right on. Bye-bye.
Have a great show. It was actress Lori Holt by phone. She's starring in the title role of Who Killed Sylvia Plath, Lynn Kaufman's play at the Marsh through June 16th. With good friend Maureen McVeary here in studio, critically acclaimed musical theater singer and comedic cabaret artist Maureen McVeary presents her new solo cabaret show, #VeryMcVeary 2019, an eclectic selection of songs about love that sparked joy. It's at the Oasis for one night only this Saturday at 7 p.m. This is an ever-evolving show for some 25 years and is presented in venues throughout the Bay Area, as well as at 88's in New York City, the Gardenia Room in L.A., and other venues around the country. In addition to cabaret for some 39 years, Maureen has been seen on stage in leading roles at ACT, the list goes on and on, the SF Shakespeare Festival, Marin Theater Company, 42nd Street Moon, Theater Works, and the Aurora Theater, among many others.
And the Playhouse.
And the SF Playhouse, where she was a beautiful Jack's mother in Into the Woods.
Yes,
what a great production.
Thank you. It was a really good one. And I am Jack's mother. I have one son. His name is Jack. God, I'm glad I got that part.
Yeah, that's perfect. And I hope you had some training with Jack that
prepared
you for that role on the stage.
That was the one show that when I would rehearse my solo, which was Jack, Head in a Sack. He was about like 8 years old, and he would go through the house going, "Stop saying that! Honey, I'm getting a paycheck. I got to practice."
Really?
Oh!
Putting food on your table, kid.
Yes, exactly.
Maureen is also the winner of 7 SF Bay Area Theater Critics Circle Awards and 2 Drama Log Awards. and also includes TV and film credits. And on the peninsula, Maureen's been running a very successful children's camp under the banner Maureen McVeary's Musical Theater Camps, the motto of which, where children learn to play on and off stage. A formal welcome to you, Maureen.
Thank you very much. And so, I'm a big fan, but I'm going to have a little bit of a suck-up moment because I'm like just like college. I waited to the witching hour.
You should take a picture of that.
Yes, and I'm giving a $120 donation because I'm actually very much addicted to KLOW. I listen all the time. You're the only ones that play Le Show.
Right,
at noon. And, you know, I'm just a huge fan, so I thought I'd better just man up.
We'll take that check with pleasure.
Thank you very much.
And thank you so much.
Yes.
While she's waving her check around, I should mention that if you're able to give us a $240 pledge, you'll get a pair of tickets to the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus and their CD. The concert is on June 22nd. $240 pledge, 800-525-9917. We still have one pair for opening night of Beautiful, the Carol King musical that's on its national tour, only here for 2 weeks. It's at the Golden Gate Theater on May 28th, opening night. Yours for a $365 contribution to KLW. Also for that amount, our good friends at the SF Playhouse have been very generous, offering three pairs of tickets to any show this season or next, excluding an opening night performance, but also includes a drink voucher for two. Also yours for a $365 pledge, 800-525-9917. On to Maureen. Boy, the show, 25 years in the making. Safe to say that in its earlier incarnations, it didn't have a hashtag to start
no,
off.
No, it's before email. Remember gigantic car phones the size of your head? Yeah, that's what this days. No, I go way back. I did that show the first time in a place, I'm pretty sure it's an office park now, but it was a place called Jolla Coco's up in Corte Madera, and the ceiling was like 12 inches above my head. But it was the first time I'd ever just got on stage and just been myself and also selected everything. You know, your job as an actor is really to just do what people ask you to do. But, you know, just doing this every couple of years just gets all desire out of to make decisions out of my system. Because I read the card, I'm like, oh, when did I write that? Yeah. But, you know, it is something. It's always just about love. Mm-hmm. Every show is about love. It's just, you know, songs I love that I think speak to love. And if there's, you know, it also, my life has changed dramatically over the last few years, but my late husband died, and it was pretty amazing afterwards. It was very sudden, but I found that afterwards, the only emotion that really sustains is love. It's very hard to just be angry forever and ever. You just remember wonderful things. So we just need to just encourage more love in this world all the time.
That's for sure. You mentioned that an actor does as they're told, and as a fellow actor and a voice actor, I know that our job is basically to audition. And you had an audition this morning. Can you tell us about it without jinxing it?
No. Well, I was the first one in. I hope nobody measures up. But it's actually a show that I saw last year at Theater Works, and it's called Native Gardens. And it's about two neighbors having an argument about 4 or 5 feet between the two properties. And it was hilarious because my friend played one of the people in that production. And so, of course, I went to see him. But he was going through an unbelievable 2.5-year drama with his neighbor. And the playwright was actually quoted as saying, she said at a dinner party, "What would happen? What's going on in everybody's world?" And they said that. So I hope I get the part. But it's also, I really recommend Center Rep in Walnut Creek. They do, I've only done 3 shows there, but it's a wonderful theater company. They just do absolutely fantastic work. Their production of Diary of Anne Frank just slayed me. It was just perfect.
If that doesn't get you the role, I don't know what will.
Michael Butler. But, you know, you were talking about David Keith, the director of Lynn Kaufman's show. He was my fake brother in another show, and he's fabulous. And I told Lynn before our interview that I was actually in a show at the Magic when her first gigantic hit just kept getting extended. And I think I was actually in and out of 2 shows while that show just kept running. So we were like the redhead stepchild next door. We've got 20 people here tonight. Meanwhile, they're packed. But yeah.
Well, you mentioned that role, potential role up in Walnut Creek. Other roles that you're looking forward to eventually doing, either on the stage or the musical theater stage?
God, I hope I work again. I got a couple things in the pipeline. No, I never plan things like that. I hope to God, if somebody's listening, you have money. You know, with all due respect to Bette Midler, etc., like, I am Dolly Levi. I am. I'm Irish. Good Lord. Come on. So I should play Hello, Dolly. Love to throw parties. I am, like, you know, money is manure. Let's spread it around.
Indeed. And we could use some of that manure here at KLW.
Oh, yeah. See, look.
$100 check for Maureen.
Anyways, I do also want to plug Oasis, where my show is, because I don't know. It's gone through so many incarnations over the last, 30 years. It was a dance club with a pool. They covered up the pool. It's now a dance floor. But I think it was about 4 years ago. I don't know if you've ever interviewed anybody on your show from Oasis, Darcy Jolinger.
Sure, yeah.
They've created such a wonderful club with consistently great entertainment, a lovely staff. And to me, that I get to be there on a Saturday night is so thrilling. They welcomed me into their world. This, you know, widow with two grown children, like, whoa, come on in. Mm. And I had my first drag king role there. I played Mr. Roper in Three's Company. Briefly, I replaced the amazing Sarah Moore for a brief time. So it's just a wonderful club and fun time.
Theoasis.org for more information. Mm-hmm. That's this Saturday only, 7 p.m. And to learn more about Maureen, go to MaureenMcMucho.com.
Yes.
Maureen, we'll have to have you in again. I wish we had more time today, but I want to go out with some of your wonderful singing. We have a track of Being Alive from one of your shows.
Oh, so my gosh.
Is that going to make it into the Saturday show?
No, but other one. I'm a big Sondheim and Cole Porter fan. I got crushes on both of them.
She's never been here before.
Before we get to that clip, we need to mention that this is our spring membership campaign. Maureen very generously offered us a $100 check coming in. That was not a $120 for coming in. But let's hear a little bit of Stephen Sondheim now as she sings so beautifully.
Someone to hold you too close. Someone to hurt you too deep. Someone to sit in your chair and ruin your sleep and make you aware of being alive. Someone to need you too much. Someone to know you too well. Someone to pull you up short and put you through hell and give you support for being alive. Being alive. Make me alive. Make me confused. Mock me with grace. Let me be you. But alone is alone, not alive. Somebody crowd me with love.
Maureen McVeary at the Oasis this Saturday evening for one performance only. Do try to catch it, theoasis.org. You've been listening to Open Air here on local public radio, KALW San Francisco. We are in our spring membership campaign and some very theater-heavy show in that we have some tickets to the opening night of Beautiful, the Carole King musical. Opening night tickets. They're only here for 2 weeks. You can be part of the crowd on Wednesday, May 28th at the Golden Gate Theater for a $365 pledge to KALW. Also, our good friends at SF Playhouse, we have three pairs of tickets that you can combine in any way you'd like. To see part of this season or next season at SF Playhouse, you can see the amazing shows that they have on offer at sfplayhouse.org. It includes a drink voucher for two, also a $365 pledge. 800-525-9917. A bit of a brief remembrance on a week that saw a lot of loss, including such incredible personalities as Tim Conway and Doris Day. We also lost a remarkable flutist by the name of Robert Stallman, an East Coast flutist who was a protege of Jean-Pierre Rampal. I played with Bob on a number of occasions, an incredible flutist and a really nice guy. Lung cancer claimed him all too early. Rest in peace, Bob, as well as those others that we lost this week. I'm David LaTulip. This has been Open Air. An hour of news from the BBC is coming up next here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco. We're online at klw.org. It's 2 o'clock.